Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also pleased in this hour of Focus to welcome back to this program someone who's been with us before on the show, once before. Catherine Bertini is her name. Right now, she's on the faculty at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University. She's a professor of public administration there. Before that, however, she had two posts at the United Nations. She was Undersecretary General for Management and was responsible for the $3 billion biennial budget, also for human resources and security for all of the staff members of the UN. Then before that, she served as executive director of the UN's World Food Program, the largest humanitarian agency in the world. Because of her work in that capacity, she was named winner of the World Food Prize in 2003. She is here visiting the campus, has been spending a couple of days, and we're pleased that she could come and spend some more time with us here on the program. The number, as we talk, if you'd like to join the conversation, 333-9455. We do also have toll-free line good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. At any point here, folks want to join the conversation, they may. The only thing we ask callers is just to try to be brief so that we can keep moving along and get in as many people as possible. But anyone's welcome to call. Thank you for being here once again.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Just in a general way, I'd like to talk a little bit about the issue of hunger. And it seems that it's complicated in the sense that there are instances where we have acute problems that may rise out of natural disaster or war, where whole societies are in complete upheaval, and we have life and death situations. And then, though, there is perhaps a larger kind of problem that doesn't get the amount of attention that the acute situations do, where we see people dealing with malnourishment, people who are inadequately nourished, who really don't get enough food to be healthy and active and to live the lives that they would like. And that's a different sort of thing. They're connected and yet that they're and different. And I'm sure much more difficult to respond to that kind of continuing low-level sort of malnutrition, maybe even more difficult to respond to that than it is to the crisis situation. We're not too bad at responding to the crisis situation. But the other thing, that's much tougher.
David, you're absolutely right. This is exactly the biggest problem in terms of addressing hunger. We see the crises, man-made or natural disasters, most recently Lebanon, for instance, the Pakistan earthquake last year, the tsunami before that, Darfur, for instance, and we rush to help if we can, if it's safe for workers to be there to help. Mm-hmm. And yes, we collectively do that pretty well. But what we don't see are the 830 million people who are desperately hungry just because they're poor, and are also poor because they're hungry. Because imagine, we all know what it's like to be hungry, even if it's for half a day. But these people are always hungry. Women give birth when they're really girls, when they're young teenagers. They haven't had enough to eat in their own lifetime. They give birth to an unhealthy child, and if that child lives, it's not necessarily because the woman can feed the child, because she doesn't have enough food herself to give that child enough milk. So the child is going to grow up stunted. And a lot of the survey research or the research shows that you have to feed a child up to about age two, otherwise she or he will have long-term developmental issues, both mental and physical. So that's the critical time, and those babies don't have the food they need. So and then they grow up and have their own babies, and it's just generational. And it's not just the health, because you don't have enough capacity to work very hard. You don't have enough capacity to learn as much in school. And it just regenerates.
Hmm. Well, that points to what is an even bigger and more complex problem, and that is poverty. And one of the things that we know is that the problem of hunger is not a supply problem. It's not a production problem. Maybe that's a better way to put it. I mean, we know how much food
access problem.
Yeah, exactly. We know we can that globally speaking, we can produce enough food to feed everybody. That's not the issue. it is an access problem, which seems mostly to come down to being a poverty problem. And then that's the kind of thing that within recent years, I mean, within the past few years, particularly at the United Nations, the nations have come together and said, look, this is some, we need to have a big comprehensive effort, all of us, to do what we can to reduce poverty around the world. And there, you know, we make reports and we put out 10-point plans and we say, okay, these are the things we're going to do. And each one of them is an enormous task, thinking about, you know, what can we do to better people's lives and improve the possibilities for them and their kids. How do you attack a problem as big, you know, as if malnutrition and hunger isn't big enough? You know, how do you approach a problem like that?
Well, again, you make a good point that the UN looks at these issues, tries to address them. But there's now the Millennium Development Goals, perhaps some of the listeners have heard about. Mm-hmm. If not, you can learn more about them on the UN website, UN.org. And the Millennium Development Goals are really the first time that the international community has come together with a broad consensus about specific goals to reach by certain years. And that includes education and health and disease and hunger and many other environment, many other indicators and goals. So I have some reasonable hopes that this is going to be the way to the future, because since everyone has agreed on it, it doesn't mean necessarily all governments are as diligent as others about it, but they can all be held accountable to it. And we can go back periodically and say, well, why haven't you made more progress in this area? And so I think that's a significant step in a positive direction. And there has been some progress on many of these goals, and it's a way to begin to assess. One of the problems in the international community is there's never enough money for evaluation. There's never enough money to really look at what the problems are. And this gets back to the issue we raised before about emergency food aid, for instance, versus helping people who are hungry because they're poor and they don't live in a so-called emergency. Every day is an emergency in their lives, but it's constant. And those emergencies, the out front emergencies that we see, we can tell. Are we feeding people? Are we taking care of the children? Have we accommodated the refugees? You can tell. But it's much more difficult to evaluate whether or not a program that serves to train women in literacy has actually worked, because there's not money available to do that evaluation. Mm.
Well, that's here we get very quickly to the issue of money, which is sort of a bottom-line issue. And you talked about the fact that it's difficult to find money to evaluate what you are doing so that you can even ask the question, is what we're doing now effective? And I'm sure that some people would say, well, heck with evaluation. We should be spending all of the money, as much money as we possibly can, on the program itself.
That's what happens. There's not enough for anything. So why evaluate it?
Right.
Let's just do it. But then over time, people say, well, why should we spend money on development? Because it doesn't work.
How do we know what we're getting for the money?
Right.
Yeah. Well, having said that, if you take a look at, say, the amount of money that developed countries spend on international development efforts aimed at trying to improve the lives of people in underdeveloped countries. When you look at how much money that is, how much money is that? I mean, is it actually possible to put a number on that?
Yes, I can't tell you what it is, but the OECD, the group of wealthy countries that gather together, I think there's 22 members based in Paris, they keep statistics, development aid statistics, and I just don't know them off the top of my head, but about how much each country gives, both in terms of overall and also per capita. And by the way, on the per capita, on the overall side, the U.S. is very large, usually first. But on the per capita side, the U.S. is usually 22nd out of 22.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there are a lot of people who would say that if we could put more money at that effort, that would be better. But is this really mostly an issue of money? I mean, what's the more important thing? How much money are we spending, or the way in which we are spending it? And could we be getting more benefit by spending the amount of money that we are spending, but maybe do it somehow, someone differently.
Well, what's absolutely most important is to spend it the right way. It doesn't matter whether we have $1 or $1 billion. If we don't spend it the right way, it's going down a rat hole. So what's the right way? Well, of course, it depends on what we're talking about, but it's critically important in my experience that we always find out what the people in need really want and need. Because if we decide on our own what we're going to do because we think this is what they need, it's not necessarily the right thing. I'll give you a couple quick examples. I visited a group of women and men in Angola, in rural Angola one time, and the internal war in Angola was still going on. But this one particular area, there was peace, and the fields had been demined, and the people wanted to go back to the fields. And some well-meaning NGO had sent hose, H-O-E-S, to help people go back to their fields. And they were complaining to me that they had been sent male hose. Now, I don't know if you or any of your listeners have ever known that there's a gender differentiation in hose.
New to me.
Me too, at the time. But a male hoe looks like the hoe that's in my, that, you know, we might use in my garden. A female, which means a male hoe, in their view, has got a long handle and a rectangular metal spade. And a female hoe is much shorter handle, and it's got more of a shovel kind of a spade with a pointed end that meets more almost like a 45-degree angle to that metal, to the wooden bowl. Now, in order to use that, you have to squat instead of bend over, and it digs further into the ground. And the women preferred it because they had babies on their backs, and it was less back-breaking to spend all day squatting than it was to bend over using the other hoe. Therefore, there was a gender differentiation in hoes. And nobody knew that because somebody said they need hoes. Okay, let's send hoes. Guess what? These hoes weren't being used because guess who are the people who work in the fields in rural Angola?
The women.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that points, that gets to what is a long time problem in international development. That is people from the developed world, no doubt well-meaning, looking at another group of people and saying, these people need help and we know what these people need. And so we drive up there with the truck or something like that and we unload the stuff and we say, here you go. Good luck. And the problem is that doesn't always work because someone hasn't first gone and talked with them and just said to them, what do you need? What can we do that exactly makes sense with you? It seems that why haven't we learned that lesson? We've been doing it that way for a long time, and we still seem to have that kind of problem of arriving thinking we got the solution, and if those people would just, you know, do what we think that they should do, they'd be fine. But it just doesn't work that way.
No, absolutely not. I've seen terracing in countries in Latin America on the sides of hills because somebody's gone in and say, oh, well, we need to terrace those hills because they'll help with erosion control. And they paid local people to terrace the hills. And they did it. It was a job. They made money. They terraced the hills. But they didn't care whether the hills were terraced, so it wasn't kept up. If somebody had asked them what they really needed, the answer would have been totally different. We need to do that. What we learned when I was at the World Food Program is that we also needed to talk more to women because our mission is to end hunger. I'm left in 2002 at the end of my term limited time. But our mission is to end hunger. And when you really think about how do you end hunger, well, yes, of course you eat, but who's going to prepare the food? We were getting food to places, but then who was going to prepare it? And the answer, of course, in the entire developing world, the answer is women. So then we needed to ask women what they needed. And when we didn't, we sent, for instance, hard kerneled corn to areas where they didn't have enough time. They had so much elsewhere to do to grind the corn themselves, and they had to spend three times as much time to boil the hard kernel corn than they would have if it was ground, and get three times as much water and firewood to do it. So if we had only asked the cooks, you know, you ask the mayor and he says, send us corn. Fine, we send corn. But he's not the cook. So we really learned through trial and error that we really needed to find ways to talk to women more often. And they're not in the leadership roles in the communities, at least not in the elected leadership roles generally. So we had to find ways to set up systems where we could get feedback from the cooks.
Yeah. I guess it just, I don't, maybe I'm belaboring this point, but it just it sort of amazes me that here we are sitting having this conversation in 2006, and we could have had the same conversation 10 years ago or 15 years ago and made the same point, that it just seems to be something that we haven't quite, I don't want to make too sweeping in generalization, but it seems that it's a problem we continue to have, and that we should be able to look back and say, you know, we had this problem before. Why don't we do things a little bit differently?
Mm-hmm.
And we're not.
Well, I think organizations learn slowly, but systemically, I'm not sure we do. I think as human beings, we think we know what somebody needs, and we'll fix it. But I think there are other ways to do it.
Our guest, let me just introduce again. Our guest, Catherine Bertini, is professor of public administration at Syracuse University at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. Before that, she was Undersecretary General for Management at the United Nations. And before that, she was Executive Director of the UN's World Food Program. That was 10 years?
10 years.
10 years. Had that job. Mm-hmm. She's here visiting the campus. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You talked briefly about the Millennium Development Goals. Mm-hmm. This is the set of very ambitious goals for international development that the members of the UN had gotten together and called that because it was around the turn of the millennium that these things were put together and put down on paper, and that they do have to do with things like improving people's health and their diet and working on the environment in developing countries, and education is a very big part of this. You said that you thought that we, in some of these areas, we already can see some progress mm-hmm. being made. If you take a look at those goals, are there particular ones where you could point to and say, here we're actually making some progress? These are the places that where so far we have done the best.
Well, the one that I think is most important and where there has been some progress is in education for all, and basic education, which is to say primary school education. But in particular, it's important for girls to be educated. It's, of course, important for boys to be educated. I don't want to diminish that import. But in so many countries, there are less girls percentage-wise that go to school than boys, and it's still not accepted in some cultures that it's important for girls to go to school. Yet, if we look at different indicators for health, for population growth, for economic development, for agriculture development, so forth, we find that the most important indicator of change is whether or not the girls have at least a primary school education. If girls have at least a primary school education, first of all, they have are likely to marry later than girls who haven't been in school. If they marry later, they're likely to have less children. They also know more about child spacing, for instance. So, in fact, girls who have at least a primary school education have half as many children, approximately 2.9 children, compared to the girls who don't, where it's over 6 children per girl. Also, since they marry later, they're more likely to marry somebody their own age rather than be married off to somebody older. So it actually has an impact on AIDS and the spread of AIDS, because if she marries somebody who's older, he's much more likely to have AIDS, give it to her. Her children are healthier. She knows more about, an educated girl knows more about how to take care of her children from a health perspective. She knows more about the kinds of food to give that child. She knows more about importance for her to eat so she can breastfeed those children successfully. If a girl is educated, she can read and write. So when there's opportunities that come her way for employment, she's more likely to be able to take advantage of them. Her children are more educated. She knows more about educating, the importance of educating her, girls and boys, and they're more likely to be educated. And on top of that, if she's in agriculture, she's more productive. And in Africa, for instance, 9 out of 10 people who work in the fields are women. And women, educated women, are more productive than others. And also, studies done by IFPRI, the International Food Policy Research Institute in Washington, show that that women, farmers, follow other women more likely than other men. So you educate some women, and a whole lot more will be productive agriculturally. If you extend that even further and look at education of women through secondary school, you'll find that that impacts on the GDP of countries.
Mm-hmm. Well, here, what no doubt you would be running up against in some places is the idea that education for girls and women just isn't important. How do you, if that's the way people in that society feel, how do you go in and sell the idea that it's a good thing for the girls to go to school?
Well, that's part of the key challenge, and I think there's different ways. I mean, intellectually, one way is to try to convince populations that if it's important for the boys to be educated, your boys spend most of their time as young children with their mother. And so she's the one that's going to have the most impact on them for their childhood. Wouldn't it be better if this major caregiver was educated, because it'll help educate your boys? Oh, and by the way, your girls. So the next generation of boys can be educated by their mothers. But there are also ways to, of course, the countries have all signed on this, so hopefully through the Millennium Development Goals this will help. But there's also more specific ways. At WFP, for instance, there are programs to give girls who finish 1 month of school cans of vegetable oil. And so you get a can of vegetable oil if you finish 1 month of school. And that has increased the numbers of girls in those schools from anywhere from 100 to 350%, because that value of that vegetable oil is worth a couple of weeks of the girl's father's salary, so it's in his interest to send her to school. Another thing that gets girls to school and boys are feeding children in school. In so many of these desperately poor communities that we talked about earlier, parents send their children to school if they're going to eat, because they're not going to eat at home. And that makes a difference, too.
We're at our midpoint here. And again, I just like to, for people who are listening, invite them into the conversation. Questions, comments are certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Again, our guest is Catherine Bertini. She's a professor of public administration at the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. Before that, she had two posts at the United Nations. She was Undersecretary General for Management. Before that, for 10 years, was Director of the UN's World Food Program. Something else, and I'm sure that we probably talked about this when you were here before, in connection with the last job that you had at the UN. As I mentioned at the beginning, one of your responsibilities was, it was not just a budget sort of responsibility, one of your responsibilities was the security of UN staff people. And something that we have seen in recent years that I think is something of a change. Certainly doing development work always has been difficult and could be dangerous. But that we had started to see in various places where there were conflicts, parties to this conflict, combatants actually deliberately targeting international aid workers, people that were there not to fight, people who weren't carrying guns, people who had gone there to try to do something to improve people's lives, creating very difficult and extremely dangerous conditions for those people to work under. And certainly we have seen places where aid workers were really needed, and yet the organizations that put them there made the decision to pull them out because they could not protect those people. And then, of course, the ones who suffered were the people in the countries that those people were there trying to help. Does that continue to be a problem?
Unfortunately, it does. If you look at the statistics in, for instance, the 80s, aid workers who died, there were very few. They died of a disease or an accident, a drowning or a traffic accident. But in the 90s, it started that aid workers were starting to be targeted. Up until then, we really thought that working under the UN flag or under the Red Cross flag, for instance, were our protection. But starting in the 90s, mid-90s, people were attacked in their UN cars or vehicles, or sometimes just directly. One of my toughest times was going to the funeral of a young Dutch woman whose mother had an even more tough time because the daughter had been killed representing WFP in Burundi, point blank range, killed a bunch of UN staff members there, and two of them were killed. And she read a letter there was a letter read at the funeral that the girl had written to her mother, saying, "It's getting more and more dangerous here, but don't worry about me, because the UN will protect me." And I was there as the head of the agency who could not protect her. And that was an example of what was happening more and more. And then for the UN, the bombing of the UN headquarters in Baghdad in August of 2003 was about the worst thing that could have happened. And it raised the issue so starkly that people now actually will go after UN staff as legitimate targets. And it's as you say, when UN staff are doing so much good work, it's changed the game. It's made more effort to have to be put in on providing safety measures for staff, although we already had since the mid-90s done a lot more. And it's even built a kind of a some tension within the staff, because some people say, well, that happened in Iraq, but it's not going to happen somewhere else, so why are we over-protecting ourselves? On the other hand, it didn't just happen in Iraq. It happened in small scale in a lot of other countries.
Well, does that happen because people think that the United Nations represents some ideological agenda, or is it that those groups, those people who might attack aid workers, think that having things be chaotic and all stirred up, that's to their advantage? They don't want things to be sort of settled down and everybody kind of getting along and things going along nice. They want things to be all churned up.
Well, you know, the Iraq situation, every listener can have his own view about why in Iraq things get blown up, and the UN was one of the first ones for that to have happened. But and we never got any real reports about it. There's only suppositions about why that was done. But as far as the other situations are concerned, some of them are just bad guys who go after these people. Why weren't they around before? I think part of it is because of in some cases, breakdowns of societal breakdowns as countries are changing. Whether that's in Eastern Europe, for instance, or in different countries in Africa. And there's a lot of other civil strife going on, and there's territorial issues about who's where and why, and UN people get in the way. But the Burundi example I cited were just bad guys. But in other cases, in the Sudan, for instance, when there was a lot of strife and war between the north and the south, and these people were kind of that were killed were kind of in the middle, so each side blamed the other side for having done it. It was probably a thing to make the other guys look bad, whomever did it. Mm-hmm. It's a variety of reasons, I think.
Well, I wonder how it is you think that people see UN workers. So if, for example, when you were head of the food program, you traveled around and you went to the places where the UN was doing the work, and I can imagine people would have looked at you and could have seen you as an American or as a representative of the West, capital W, whatever that means, or as a representative of the developed world, big industrial countries, or as a representative of the United Nations. And then there would be the question was, well, what exactly does that mean? Do we really understand what the United Nations is all about? I mean, how do you think people, what do they think the United Nations is, and who really has the power in the United Nations?
The vast majority of people in the vast majority of countries welcome the United Nations and all the people that work there, including the leadership, as people who are there very legitimately and with all good intent to help support the needs of the people. And so, sure, in my case, people knew I was an American, but I was there as the head of a UN agency. Me and all the staff, and the vast majority of times, were accorded with the appropriate protection. And respect is not the right word, but understanding of our intentions as being honorable. I think that sometimes there are issues when some countries, because of circumstances going on, question the political intent of the United Nations, and then they say, and then they might be suspicious about why some UN agencies are there. But I think for the humanitarians, it's generally not the case. I think for the humanitarians, people know that they're there to work with both sides, if there are two sides of a problem, and to do their best to help feed people. So I think that's less of a problem.
Yeah. I'm sure in doing that job, you saw some incredible things, like other, you know, people who just go about their regular old lives just couldn't even imagine some of the things probably that you've seen. When you go into a situation like that, and I mentioned the fact that the World Food Program is the biggest humanitarian agency in the world, so you're there and you can sort of say to yourself, behind me, I have the weight of the world's biggest humanitarian agency. This is the United Nations, you know. We have really significant resources. And yet, were there times when you might have been in a particular place and you looked at the situation, and you looked at the conditions under people living, and you just thought to yourself, well, what in the world are we going to do about this? How can we possibly deal with it? You know, whatever it was.
You see very bad situations and many people living in them, but at the same time you see what you're doing, and even though you know what you're doing is this very small piece of the overall, addressing a very small piece of the overall problem, you really concentrate on the benefits of that and what you've been able to achieve. So even on the really dark days of difficulty for a humanitarian worker, you're able to sleep at night because you know there are many people who are alive because of your help. And that really keeps people going. In fact, invigorates people that work in very difficult situations throughout the world. I guess if I got really bothered, it was more thinking about governments shirking their own responsibilities. And it's not just governments in war, but also governments in peace who aren't paying attention to their people living in desperate poverty. Mm-hmm. And that's, you just kind of get really personally angry. There's nothing you can do about it, but you also have to let it go away because you're there to do a different job.
What, you're talking about governments neglecting the needs of their own people or other governments who maybe could do something to help?
No, neglecting the needs of their own people.
We have a couple of callers here. Why don't we bring them into the conversation? Let me give the telephone number, by the way, 333-9455. That's for people who are in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are. We do also have the toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Here's someone to start us off in Chicago, line number 4.
Thank you.
Yes.
As you said, this talk could have been given 10 years ago, and hopefully we would see more progress along the lines of the discussion. However, one area you touched upon in the beginning, where there's no problem with the matter of productivity, while we may be experiencing greater action occurring as a result of geophysical actions such as hurricanes and earthquakes and other typhoons and monsoons of an order that we haven't experienced before, we're certainly seeing that action occurring in the oceans where offshore in the Gulf and on the West Coast recently, they experienced a lack of oxygen in the water such that life does not exist as we've known it for the fisheries and other algae that are growing, and the food chain is being so altered. And similarly, we're experiencing droughts on the one hand and floods on another, such that we may have to begin to think of displacement of the productivity breadbaskets to other areas of continued drought and other things that are occurring, and blight and so forth. And so we have to begin to possibly project other areas for development of agricultural food chains in the future. I don't know how much thought has been given to that displacement of the food productivity.
Well, is that something you can talk about?
Well, we've certainly seen many more natural disasters, a lot more flooding, certainly. And that does have an impact on people's lives. But if we are able to find more ways to help more people in terms of productive agriculture in their own locations, that would be extremely useful. I'm one of the people who was very disappointed that the Doha trade round wasn't successful, and certainly hopeful that the U.S. government would do more to bring it back for some real discussion, because it's in our interest as Americans as well as our interest as world citizens to support the agricultural production in many developing countries around the world and their ability to trade, to sell their goods.
Thank you.
Thank you. So do you think, or is there some concern that if climate change is as serious as some people say that it is, that there might be some permanent or very long-term changes that would mean there are certain parts of the world simply aren't going to be able to produce the amount of food that maybe they used to or that they need to, and then that might be something that in some places you'd have to deal with for a long time.
I'm not an agriculture expert. I can't tell you that.
Okay. Let's talk with someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I was wanting to know, could you talk a little bit about the availability of food in the developed world and why it might not be getting to people who need it?
There's more than enough food grown in the world for every man, woman, and child in the world, but it's the access issue, and people can't buy it, don't have the ability to buy it, or don't have the ability to grow it, and that's really the bottom line of the issue. We, the U.S. and other countries, do send a lot of food overseas, have to help people living in emergencies, not enough in my view to help people to work their way out of poverty. For instance, we could do a lot more with our food aid to be supporting people who are moving into cash crop farming and supporting them while they're developing their new crops. We could be doing a lot more to help feed children in school. We do a lot, but we could do a lot more. So those are, I think, very significant ways that we could use more. More food aid from developed countries. But as far as purchasing, it's a question of the purchasing power. And the more we can help countries build their own economic power through their own ability to grow food and manufacture goods, then they'd be more able to buy products from the U.S. and elsewhere.
Well, isn't that also a problem where if you give too much food away, you're basically dumping product on a market that basically ruins the local farming economy?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You have to be very careful what you send. And there's one program that I've always been concerned about, but that the U.S. government, two programs actually. One is that the U.S. government would send food just as part of their own foreign policy programs, for instance, and just give it to a country and say, here's X tons of wheat or whatever. And then the country then sells it in their own country, which often undermines the market. Fortunately, the U.S. government doesn't do that anymore, has really phased it almost out. But there's another program called monetization where U.S. product would be shipped overseas and sold, and then the funds for that go for an NGO, for instance, to help do their own projects in another country. It's kind of a silly way to help support the NGOs. We should just send cash. It's give them cash in this case because they do wonderful work. But the whole idea of shipping the food overseas, selling it where it could potentially disrupt a market, and then not even using it for food aid doesn't even make sense. And it's not cost effective.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to Belgium over by Danville, line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have an observation and a question. Here in the Midwest, where we're talking to you from, there's rapid growth in biofuels, whether it's biodiesel or it's ethanol, and these plants and facilities are growing at a very rapid rate in this part of the United States. And obviously they use the products that you're interested in sending to the rest of the world. And the rest of the world eats in many ways. And as the price of fuel keeps going up, petroleum, crude oil keeps going up, we're going to rapidly move in this direction much quicker. This is going to have an effect on your ability to produce food for the rest of the world, especially as we keep wanting to produce more and more fuel because we have plenty of food to eat, but we don't have enough fuel. So we're going to convert more and more of our excess to fuel. How is that going to affect your situation?
Yeah, you must be a real futurist to think about this. I think it's a good point over the long term that if fuel starts becoming competitive with food, we may have a problem beyond the developing countries, but even in our own country. But on the other hand, we have a responsibility to try to come up with other alternative sources of fuel. It's something I think we need to be extremely careful about. And one of the good things is that they're experimenting with a lot of different kinds of sources for biofuels, and And that's certainly a positive step. And while now and in the near-term future, there's not going to be a competitiveness, I think over the long term, one has to think about that. I don't think it's a reason to stop experiment and expansion now. But it is something that then, you know, one will have to balance over the long term in the future.
Well, one of the other land-grant colleges, namely Purdue over at Lafayette, is doing a lot of work in cellulosic alcohol. In other words, you change all of the plant into alcohol instead of just the corn or just the wheat seeds or just the bean seeds, which I think we all should be pushing harder and harder to go to that and save the actual corn and the wheat and the beans for food and turn all the rest of the plant into alcohol. But we're just now working in that direction, and I can only laud those efforts, which would be much better than what we're doing right now. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call. Certainly there are some people here at the University of Illinois that are doing that same.
Well, yeah, it's very important.
Same
research is absolutely critical, and the expansion is absolutely critical. And I think it's, you know, it's a very much a developing industry, and so I think we shouldn't put a lot of caps on that development, but over time we have to be sure we get the balance right between food and fuel, but that's not an issue at this point in time.
We have about 10 minutes, maybe a little bit less, in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Catherine Bertini. She's professor of public administration at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs of Syracuse University. Before that, she held two posts at the United Nations. She was Undersecretary General for Management, and then before that, for 10 years, she was the executive director of the UN's World Food Program, and she has been here visiting the campus for a couple of days and talking with students, and I'm glad she could come and just spend a little time with us.
Thanks. It's been a wonderful time here. I'm a guest of the Civic Leadership Fellow program, and with Professor Jim Nolan, and he has organized a really impressive group of U of I undergraduates and people working on master's degrees who are really committed to serving their country and the world in the future. And so it's been a real delight to be here with him.
He's a good guy, Jim. I haven't talked to him in a long time, so say hi if you get the opportunity.
Today's his birthday, I should tell you.
Happy birthday, Jim. I mentioned the fact that here that you, after having been at the World Food Program, you were Undersecretary General for Management. And this was at a time when the United Nations was facing a lot of criticism, particularly from the United States. I'm not sure that that's new, but this was at a time where it seems that it might have even been more than I can remember in the past, when there was a lot of criticism about the United Nations and the way that it was run. And people were raising issues about was it run efficiently, and was this a top-heavy bureaucracy, and was money being wasted, and was this a corrupt organization? And there are all kinds of very, very strong, very negative things being said. And here you stepped into this job where suddenly now you became the person who was really responsible for the way that this was run. The Secretary General asked you to do this, and I'm sure that you said, yes, you would, and in the back of your mind said, thank you very much for this great honor. Would that it had passed to somebody else. Where does that stand now? As certainly a lot of things were said about, even Mr. Annan said, yes, we think that the United Nations could be run better, and we want to look at these things very seriously. Recommendations were made about restructuring and so forth. Where does that all stand now?
Mm. Interesting that you ask. I'm going to speak about that on Monday in Chicago at the National Strategy Forum. Yes, Kofi Annan asked me to do five jobs. He reappointed me to the World Food Program job. He appointed me to this job running essentially administrative programs of the UN as Undersecretary General for Management. He appointed me in charge of security. And then twice I was a special envoy for him, once for the drought in the Horn of Africa in 2000 and once for humanitarian issues in Gaza and the West Bank. When he first came in as Secretary General in 97, he outlined a very strong change proposal for the UN, much of which was accepted by the member states and put in place. And he really brought together a lot of the UN agencies that hadn't paid much attention to central leadership before, and really built more of a family of the UN as he should, because the UN is very diverse, humanitarian agencies, peacekeeping, research entities, and so forth. And he brought a lot of that together so that he could exercise more authority as the head of the UN over these agencies. And that was a very good and important move. I think some of the issues like the oil for food issue show that that managing the UN is not as simple as even managing a government and the government agencies that are more specifically under the direct control of the president or the prime minister. Because in this case, not only does he have agencies that aren't under his – many who aren't under his direct control, but he also has 191 member states who are the UN members who play very active roles in the operation of the UN itself. And those roles that they play make it extremely difficult to handle day-to-day management issues. And I think oil for food was unfortunately a very a good example with a bad thing happening that was for a lot of different reasons a problem. Issues that could have been dealt with by within the management area, but also issues that could have been dealt with by the government.
Mm-hmm. Well, was this simply a case where, and maybe you're not surprised that you would find that there would be individuals who were in an opportunity to enrich themselves, took the opportunity, and that this was just, it was a small number of people who did, maybe just even a couple of people who did that, and that's maybe in something as big as that, with as much money involved as that, you know, you wouldn't be surprised that maybe somebody would decide, I can put some money in my pocket here.
There's one UN staff member who's been accused by the Volcker Commission of having taken $100,000+ in this process. And if that is correct, and he did, obviously it's deplorable. But I want to emphasize there's one. Most of the issues that have been discussed about the abuse of the money came from the padding by the Iraqi government of the contracts, so if a contract costs $100,000 and they said, well, it will really cost you $125,000, and they took the $25,000, did something else with it, that is the real tragedy of this program.
Just as a way of finishing up here to underline the point you already make, and I think it's something that people really don't appreciate enough when they criticize the United Nations, is that it's the United Nations is only as strong as the member states and only has the authority and the resources that the member states are willing to give it. And that, you know, you can criticize the Secretary General all day long, but he's got to somehow round up, you know, for anything the United Nations decides to do or anything he decides is important, he's got to round up enough support to make that happen. And when you're dealing with all these different countries and all their different agendas and what they think is important, that seems to me to be a not a small task.
It's very difficult, and I would never sit here or anywhere else and say the UN is perfect and the management is perfect or anyone is perfect. But when you think about when somebody says, "Oh, the UN is terrible," what are they really talking about? Mm-hmm. One quick example is Lebanon, for instance. People say, "Oh, we've had peacekeepers in Lebanon and they haven't done anything. How come they haven't handled all these problems with Hezbollah and between Lebanon and Israel and so forth?" Well, the resolution from 1978 says that they use their weapons only to protect themselves. So how can you really keep a peace from somebody building their own defense forces if the only way you can handle it is by talking? Then why bother sending soldiers at all? But nonetheless, this was decided by the UN in 1978. So somebody said, well, they haven't worked. Well, why? Because the resolution says that these were their rules. Now, hopefully, the new force will make a difference, but they have to and they will be able to be real soldiers.
Yeah. Well, that certainly was a case where, and I remember finally once it seemed like a tentative agreement for a ceasefire was agreed upon, I heard the Secretary General talking about essentially saying, I am deeply disappointed that it took us this long to do this. And you'd have to appreciate the fact that, well, it was not something he couldn't do. He couldn't do it by himself.
No, he had to have the U.S. and France and everybody else on board. Same with sending a force to Darfur. And that's still not there, but he's pushes, but he can't create without the approval of the governments. Yeah.
Well, there we're going to have to stop here for the moment with thanks to our guest, Catherine Bertini. She's professor of public administration at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs of Syracuse University. She is former Undersecretary General for Management at the United Nations and also for 10 years was the executive director of the UN's World Food Program. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.